I've just come back from Indonesia. I've got a cough over there, giving many, many talks to literally thousands of people. But it's quite something to turn up to a talk in a huge hotel ballroom with 5,000 people sitting there waiting for you to entertain them. There was those huge numbers, 5,000, 3,500, in different places throughout Indonesia. But often people ask me, how can you do that, to give a talk to so many people, and often without any preparation at all, usually no preparation. And it's something which I have, which I've developed over many years, which is like in trust in the moment. And the whole topic of this evening's talk is about trust and its real importance. Because when we have trust, it's the opposite of controlling. When we have trust, there's a sense of giving yourself to this moment and giving it the opportunity to prove itself. Whereas whenever we're afraid of being hurt or afraid of making mistakes, that's when we always have so much control. And you see in our modern societies, with so much fear and lack of trust in our societies, we tend to have CCTV cameras everywhere and checking up on each other. Which means that, you know, husbands don't trust wives, wives don't trust husbands, boyfriends don't trust each other, and our boss doesn't trust us. And that comes down eventually to we don't trust ourselves. And that's a very sad world to live in. And so I know that when I was growing up, I was said that trust should be earned. And I've often contemplated that. No, it can't be earned. Trust has to be given. In other words, each one of us has to understand the importance of trust and to give it to others. Because giving trust is one way of allowing other people to make mistakes and realizing that even though they do make mistakes, even though our trust is not lived up to 100%, nevertheless it was worth giving. Because the alternative is like fear, lack of trust, and then eventually just controlling each other. And that's no way to live any life. But of course, many of you have been, say, in relationships where someone has let you down. But what actually is going on there is well illustrated by an old story. And again, I have to apologize for telling these stories again and again, but there are many people come for the first time. We do have a turnover in this city center, so not everyone has come to every talk in the last 27 years. I know some people have, like Dennis. So that sometimes these stories, they are well worth repeating because they make a very powerful point about trust. And this was a case of giving a lecture in a university outside of Kuala Lumpur several years ago. And at the end of the talk, a lady sort of asked a question, and the question was a very pertinent one. But I rose to the occasion and gave a really great answer, which I'm going to share with you. And the question was that this woman said she found out that her husband had lied to her that very morning. She couldn't trust him any longer. Should she get divorced? And that was a question in public. Now, this lady was brave enough to say that she thought her relationship was in trouble and asked me in public to tell her whether to get divorced or not. You get really asked some interesting questions being a monk. Again, I don't know why people ask me about marriage questions when I've never been married. But nevertheless, I asked her two questions back because I wanted more information. The first was how long she had been married, and she said only 3 years. And the second question was what she was doing at that university. And she said she was teaching. She was teaching mathematics. And that gave me a way of answering her question. Because at university I was a physicist, but that also included a lot of mathematics. So I said we can do some statistics. 3 years of marriage, let's say 1,000 days. They give or take a few days here and there. And let's assume for the sake of this argument that over those 3 years of marriage, or that's 1,000 days, your husband has said, say, 20 things to you on average every day, which could be right, which could be wrong. So since you've been married, he said 20,000 statements to you, and now he's lied for the first time. According to probability theory, that means the next time your husband opens his mouth, there's a 20,000-to-1 chance he's telling the truth. What do you mean you can't trust him? When I put it that way, just one lie, which was going to be the cause of a divorce, was put in perspective. It was no reason to take away her trust to what her husband said. And I love that story because how many people, just one thing goes wrong and you take away your trust. Some person makes one or two mistakes and you say, I can't trust them any longer. Your trust is not wise. Your trust is not reasonable. Your trust is expecting something which the world will never give 100%. So instead, we should have this magnanimous mind, which is what we encourage in religions like Buddhism, to trust a person, even if they let you down, and to trust them again, if they let you down a second time, because you have it in perspective. Yeah, no, once or twice they make mistakes, but for many, many times they actually live up to your trust. And trust is given, and when you give it, the other person who receives it, they usually get better at deserving that trust. But it has to be given first of all. That's why the best time to start giving trust is with our children. We have to trust them. When you let them go to school, you don't need to sort of ferry them backwards and forwards and make sure there's no way they can get into any danger or trouble, because that is not trusting your kids at all. There does come a time when you have to trust that they know how to look after themselves. And you have to trust their judgment. And of course, that means they make mistakes. Now, as long as they're not sort of too dangerous mistakes. Trusting your children means allowing them to make mistakes, allowing them to hurt themselves, because that's how we learn. In Dharma, in Buddhism, there's nothing wrong with making mistakes. I remember when I was a school teacher, I had to set mathematics exams. I was a maths teacher and science teacher at school for 1 year before I became a monk. As I often say, and many school teachers here would probably understand what I mean, but if you teach in a high school for 1 year, I think everybody will consider becoming a monk and leaving the world. It's one of the toughest jobs in the world, facing teenagers. But when I was a teacher, I had to set some maths exams, and sometimes I set them too easy, and everyone got 10 out of 10 or 9 out of 10. That was not a good examination. Sometimes you set them too hard, and no one scored 1 or 2 out of 10. That's the most. And that was a bad exam. That was too tough. The best exams were when you'd encourage people, because they did well, 6, 7, 8, 9 out of 10. But you also made it tough enough, I could see their weak points, because every time they made a mistake, I realized there was something which I wasn't teaching fully enough that they could really understand. So as a school teacher setting examinations, I had to make sure that they did make some mistakes so I could learn where their weak points were, and therefore I could help them strengthen those weak points. But if we never find those weak points because the exam is too easy, where can there be any learning? Where can there be any growth? And that's the same in life. We have to allow ourselves and others to make those mistakes, because that's where our growth is. We all know what we can do, but what we really want to find out is what we can't do, where our weaknesses are. And that's where we do our work in life. So when we do make mistakes, great, that's where we learn from. So trusting another person, trusting your kids, yeah, they will make mistakes, and that's where we can learn. Okay, kid, you weren't smart there, you were stupid there. Now let's come together and find out how you can be stronger in those areas. But if you don't trust your kids at all, those weak points in their character, in their wisdom, in the way they deal with the problems in their life will never be seen. and they'll be a very, very weak child or adult when they grow up. So trust is there, not just to make sure that they never make mistakes, but to allow mistakes. Mistakes are part of life. That's why that a long time ago I heard that when you do make a mistake, we don't just call it failure, we call it forward failing. And forward failing means, it adds, when you just put the word forward, it means that you're going to grow and learn and become better from making mistakes. So that's why we allow everybody to make a mistake. So in the monastery, I often say there's one place where you feel you can make a mistake. And it's okay to make a mistake, not to be perfect. When I first heard that, I thought, wow, you mean I don't have to be perfect in this place? No, you can make mistakes. And that took a lot of this pressure off you. A lot of this pressure to never make mistakes, to be perfect, and what happens when you do make mistakes? You cover it up so no one finds out. And when you realize you can make mistakes, it means you relax and you tend not to make as many mistakes. Because a lot of times we make many, many mistakes when we're so afraid, we're sort of tense. Whether it's at work or at home, my goodness, if my husband finds out what I've done, I'll be in big trouble. With that type of attitude, obviously you're tense and you tend to make more mistakes. When you relax a bit, oh, if I make a mistake, you know, I'm trying my very best. My husband, my partner will understand. You find you can relax more. When you relax more, you tend to make less mistakes. So allowing yourself to make mistakes, trusting yourself that it's okay to make mistakes, means we grow and we learn and we have a far better positive attitude to ourselves and towards life. So that has to also be with our children, with our partners. And the point is, once there is that trust there, it means you're not going to control another person. You're not going to tell them what to do, because the lack of trust is what's pervasive in our society. We don't trust people to do the right thing. We have so many speed cameras and red light cameras and so many people looking over you and checking your tax returns and everything else. We live in a very untrustworthy society. We don't trust our politicians. You don't trust the used car salesperson. There's so many people you don't trust. I hope at least you trust the monks here. Who else can you trust in life? And why is it so difficult to trust people? And I think a lot of it is because we don't give that trust enough. We're too doubters. We're too fault finders. And that comes maybe from our childhood and from our families. So if you can give that trust to your children, psychologically you'll probably find that your children live up to that trust. Give them that trust. Give them the chance to prove themselves. But they need that chance first of all. They can't earn it. They've got no sort of capital to invest. You've got to give them some trust first of all. And when you do give them that trust, if they do make a mistake, great, this is where you're learning their weaknesses. So you don't punish them for making mistakes. This is one of the reasons why people lose trust in each other and lose trust in being understood. Because we all, as a person who's been around a long time and visiting people in all levels of society, you know, from rich people and politicians and royalty to people in prisons and bricklayers, all levels of society is what I hang out with. And knowing so many people, I always have this experiential wisdom that most people, 99.99% of people, have just really got good hearts. They're trying to do their very best. Just give them a chance and they will rise to the occasion. But a lot of times they're not given that chance. They make a mistake and straight away, one mistake, one lie, that's it, we're getting divorced. Right, that's it, you can't be my friend anymore. That's probably it, I don't trust you anymore. We take away our trust far too easily. Which means we get very, very lonely and we live in this very, very doubtful society where we don't trust anybody at all. What sort of society is that to live in? What sort of home is that to live in? What sort of community is that to live in where we don't trust each other at all? So I do believe that we should give that trust And even if we do get let down, we learn. Once there is that trust there, especially in a family, if a mistake is made, there's also that understanding that it's more important to maintain the trust than to punish a mistake. So if you, if you keep punishing mistakes, what happens is that people stop admitting their mistakes. They cover it up. They lie. I've often wondered why it is that it's so hard in our modern world to tell the truth. And the reason is because if you tell the truth, you lose a lot of benefits. And if you lie, there are many advantages. And I want to try and change just the way that our world works so that lying has hardly any advantages and telling the truth has more benefits. And again, that can start in your own families. Now, if your child comes up to you and says he's taken drugs, or this, you know, your daughter has got pregnant or something, or your son has got into trouble with the police, instead of saying, "You naughty boy, terrible kid," and punish them, look, they've actually been honest to you. They've come and owned up something terrible which they have done. That is more important than punishment. They've been honest to you, and they've said that because they want you, the parent they love, they trust, to try and help you, try and get through that problem, and make sure you never actually do that terrible thing again. They want help. They don't want punishment. And you can imagine if your child could trust you enough that you went up, you know, they came up and said they did this terrible, terrible thing, and mummy and daddy said, "Well, that's an awful thing you've done, but we understand you make mistakes. We all make mistakes in life. We all done some stupid things." Sometimes people ask me when I grew up, what was the most stupid thing I did when I was a kid? I know one of the most stupid things I did as a kid, only 10 years of age, and one of my best friends, I still remember his name, Christopher Nightingale, he was a whiz at chemistry, and together we made a bomb. We made a bomb in a tin can. And my goodness, it worked! We let it off in the local park, it went bang! And we thought we were so good and so wonderful. I was so proud of just how loud that went. Until the park keeper caught the both of us. We were in big trouble after that. But you know, those were the days when it's just kids being kids. You know, if I made a bomb these days, kids made a bomb these days, they get sent to Guantanamo Bay as terrorists. It's those innocent days of my youth. That was dangerous. I could have killed myself or blown off a hand or something. But, you know, we all do stupid things, you know, when we were young. And I'm sure that, you've all done stupid things. So instead of being punished, you know, by that, we learn from it. So you know, if you can go up to your father or your mother and say, "This is what I've done. I'm being really honest." Wouldn't it be wonderful if there was no fear of punishment, but your parents were there to help you? To understand, you know, you're just experimenting with life, learning things, making mistakes, and what you really want is trust, that you really have the right intentions. You made a mistake. Can you please help me to make sure, you know, I never get in that situation again. I never, you know, get with those people who take drugs, or I never sort of get myself pregnant again. So what parents need to be there to help. And unless there is that trust, that you can actually go up to your parents and tell the truth without any fear of punishment, then it means it's in your interest to lie. There's no point in telling the truth if you're just going to get punished. You're not going to be understood. And that means your kids will lie to you. And worse, they won't have anyone to really help them when they truly need it, because they'll be afraid of you. Same with husbands and wives or partners in any relationship. I always say that in a relationship that should be one unit where that you can say anything to your partner. I mean, literally mean anything. Even a thing which would be very hurtful to them out of honesty. And you are listened to and respected. And honesty is respected much more than anything else you've done. Yeah, you may have had an affair with somebody else. But you're telling your wife or you're telling your husband. Why are you telling them anyway? You're telling them because you still have that love towards that person. the one you've married, the one you've committed to, but you made a mistake, a big mistake. And you're telling them because you want some help. Some help to get rid of that situation and to come back to the person you really want to commit to. Otherwise, why would you want to tell anyway if you didn't want to mend the situation and stop the damage? But what happens most times? People are afraid to tell the one they love. They're afraid because they think, you know, they're going to get punished, the person's going to go berserk, they're going to hit them, they're going to divorce or whatever. That fear of punishment means that it's not in anyone's interest, to be honest. And that's where the lies come from. That's why the lack of trust is there. Trust, honesty, should be held so high that if your partner tells you anything, and they're honest, if it's absolute honesty, it should always come with 100% amnesty. Amnesty means your partner can tell you anything, and you know they'll be forgiven. And then you work together to make sure that it never happens again. You never get yourself in a situation where you have lust with a person who works in your office. You never get in that situation where you feel you need to break the law and take these drugs. You never get in that situation where you do a terrible, harmful, hurtful thing. You need those strategies, but you're allowed to make mistakes. And the loved person, the one you trust, is there to help you. That's why in the Catholic Church, if you go and tell a priest something, they are bound with confidentiality. Even if they say they've broken the law, the priest would go to jail rather than actually say to the police, you know, what you actually told them. Because that is total trust, total acceptance there. And that's something which I admire about that form of religion. You can go into that confession box, tell the priest anything, and that priest is bound not to tell anybody else. That should be actually just the bond which we have between the people we love the most. Total trust. And that's a wonderful thing to have, which means that you've got someone you can tell anything to, and you know you'll be understood. Yeah, you're fragile, you're frail, you make mistakes, we all do. But you trust that person enough, and they trust you. There's something bigger than mistakes. Which means you can tell them anything. And it's that thing which is bigger than making mistakes, bigger than hurt, is that trust. And we have to give that. And that means in a relationship, because of that wonderful 100% trust, there's no need to lie. It's in our interest to tell the truth. Yeah, we will hurt our partner, we will hurt our mother and father by telling what they did. We will hurt them more if we don't. And we know that by telling, by confessing, by opening up, there'll be two or three people to help you through to make sure that, you know, you can get out of that fix and you never need to do that wrong thing again. So trust is not earned. Trust has to be given. And the more it's given, I think the better our society would be. We live in a very punitive society. You can see just the way we treat, you know, people who commit crimes in jail. We throw them in jail to punish them. And every psychologist, psychiatrist, anyone who knows the nature of the mind knows that doesn't really help. Demeaning a human being, diminishing them as if they're sort of some rubbish, as if they're dregs of society. That just often makes people worse. And that's a very good example that, you know, okay, we can put people in prison and just make more sort of bad people at the end of their stay, usually. But we do that to each other as well. Our partner makes a mistake. Right, that's it, I can't live with you any longer. Out of here. Instead of talking together, understanding and working together to sort of make things, understanding that if there is that trust there, and that trust should always be given and re-given and re-given and re-given and re-given. It doesn't matter how many times. Because the alternative is this doubting, fear, and of course that's no way you can have any relationship at all with anybody. And of course, not even with yourself. No matter how many people don't trust themselves. That's one of the things which I learned from Buddhism, to trust myself. So I do these amazing things, you know, just go and sort of give a talk to 5,000 people. I'll go on the TV in Indonesia, just a big TV show, this interviewer who interviews all sorts of famous people. And you go on there and you just trust in the moment. You trust in yourself. You can relax. If you make a mistake, I laugh. That's one of the nice things which I learn of being a monk. When you really relax, you allow yourself to make a mistake when you give a talk. And if I make a mistake during my talk, of course, what happens? Everybody laughs. And I laugh as well, because I realize I've made people happy. So I never feel embarrassed if I make mistakes. Making a mistake in public, giving a speech, is a great sort of lightener for everybody. And who knows, if I really make a big mistake on TV, I may be able to make thousands of people happy by going on that TV show, was it Bloopers? When people do stupid things on TV. See, is that what it's called, bloopers or something? Yeah, I mean, you're all smiling when I mention that word. So whoever does those terrible mistakes on TV and goes on that TV bloopers, oh, it creates so much happiness for many people, thousands of people in the world, when they do stupid things. What they're saying is, yeah, they're human and I'm human. I make mistakes as well. That's the nature of this world. So by doing such things, by learning just how not to be afraid of making mistakes, you can trust yourself. But how many people are very fearful? I mean, obviously, I'm a monk for life, so I'm not interested in relationships, but how many of you are single and would love to sort of find a partner, but just too afraid to go out there and try, give it a go? And why is that? Because, you know, you're just too afraid of making mistakes. You don't trust yourself. So it's great to know I can make a mistake, I can do something foolish, and if I do something foolish, they laugh at me, and I laugh with them. And that way, that very famous saying, because sometimes these one-liners are what you really remember in life, that way the world will never laugh at you, it will only laugh with you. It's a beautiful saying. So when you laugh at yourself when you make mistakes, the world never laughs with you. Never laughs at you, rather. Only laughs with you. See, I made a mistake. See, it made people laugh. So that's really good. So that way you can trust yourself. And when you trust yourself, what's that called? Confidence. And with that sort of confidence, number one, it's easy to find partners in life, because that's what people are looking for. And you can give that confidence to the other person, to trust each other, and that's where we have this beautiful growth as human beings. Now, in trusting each other, what we're really saying, look, I'm fragile, I make mistakes, sometimes I'm very stupid. Please love me for that. And I'm not going to sort of hide that from you. This, I trust you to understand that, and I will trust you, to be imperfect. And trusting in the imperfection of another means you don't no longer need to sort of control them anymore. Trust in the imperfection of your kids. They will be naughty from time to time. They will sort of not follow your advice from time to time. But that's what they have to do to learn. That's what you did. That's what I did. And that's the only way that we grow in this life. Pushing boundaries, and sometimes realize we push too far, we get into trouble. That's the only way we learn, when we put our finger in the fire and it gets burnt. Yeah, that's what my daddy told me, but I've got to learn it for myself. As long as you don't do it too many times. But this is where we trust each other and we trust life. And trusting life is one of the nicest things. Because in trusting life, you realize that as long as you've got that right attitude towards life, it's amazing just what you can do. And just you trust that no matter what happens to you in life, you get sick, you get sort of old, you make mistakes, you have this beautiful sense of trust in just the goodness of the world. Whenever I go anywhere, people kept asking me in Indonesia, why don't you travel with somebody, someone who can look after you in case you miss the plane? And I said, look, wherever I go in the world, I always travel with many attendants. They're called flight attendants. They always look after me in the aircraft. There's always someone to look after me when I get there. And I have a lot of trust in the goodness of people. No matter if you get stuck somewhere, you can just ask someone, and they're good enough to always to be kind to you and help you. Many, many times I've actually missed an aircraft, or you got stuck in the airport, and there's been
the aircraft has been delayed or cancelled or something. And I've got no money. I've got no mobile phone. When I'm stuck, I am stuck. There's always some kind person who will look after you and just, you know, let them borrow the mobile phone or do something for you. And that's one of the nice things. I trust the kindness in people. And yes, sometimes people might be cruel. They might let you down. They might abuse your trust. But I'd rather live in a world of trust than a world of fear. I've made that world. And because I expect and trust people, most of the time they live up to that trust. You know, from the very time I became a monk, you had to trust that someone's going to feed you tomorrow. And sometimes they didn't when I first came here. When we first came here, we lived in a little house in Magnolia Street, you know, with Ajahn Chacko, the two of us. And we have a rule that, you know, we can't sort of eat food ourselves. It has to be presented to us in the morning time. It's presented the night before, the day before. That's it. We can't eat it. It has to be presented to us that particular day. And it did happen many times. We get up in the morning and no one came. And we looked inside the fridge. The fridge was full of food. And we're counting down till noon. We can't eat afternoon. 11 o'clock, still no one had come. And you could look inside the fridge and all this food was there. 11:30, still no one had come. 11:55, 12 o'clock, no food that day. But you survive, it's only just fasting for a day, it's no big deal. But that was only in the first few, you know, year or two of being a monk over here. And that wasn't that bad. Actually, you know the worst suffering I ever had when I first came here? There was this house in Magnolia Street, North Perth, where we first lived. Because one day they were doing this fundraiser for the monastery down at Serpentine. They decided to have a cake store. So one Friday night, it's only a small house, and a really small house in North Perth. And everybody brought these cakes, they're home-baked cakes. And they put them, you know, in the kitchen. Maybe about 100 cakes there. And you know what a freshly baked cake that smells like. And everybody went home after the Friday evening. And I went into the room right next to the kitchen. That was my bedroom where I slept. You couldn't sleep. You had all this aroma of freshly baked cakes in your room. And you couldn't eat any of them. And it was really unfair. And all you could smell all night is like the smell of freshly baked cakes. That was the most tortured evening I ever had. Gosh, you could smell them. You can't eat them. But anyway, you know, you trust that people will feed you. You trust that people will look after you. Even when I go overseas, I don't have any insurance. And I do that on purpose. And sometimes people, you're crazy, Ajahn Brahm. You know, what happens if you have an accident? And I trust there's plenty of kind people over where I go who will look after me. And I trust them, and I know they will. I trusted this one time when I went into Canning Vale jail. I went into Canning Vale jail once, and when I went in there, the prison officers told me they had a new security system installed because there had been many violent rapes. This was a male-to-male rapes, so I was a possible victim, especially looking like this. And some of these prisoners, they got very little to lose, being there a long, long time. So they said a new security system has been installed. And they gave me this pen, this ballpoint pen. They said, put it in your pocket. And I looked at them and said, what do you mean, pocket? Look at me, I don't have pockets. They just hold it, do something with it. It is a ballpoint pen. But it also is a security device as well. And all you need to do, he said, is point the pen as many sensors on the ceiling. And he pointed out what the sensor looked like. And if you get attacked, point the pen at one of the sensors, press the little button at the top, the alarm will go off, we'll know exactly where you are, and we'll come and get you to protect you from the rape. Thank you very much. So I had to carry it with me. But they also said, this is, you know, top secret. Don't tell any of the prisoners. So I went into my meditation group, and the first thing somebody said was, oh, you've got one of those security pens too. And of course, you know, these are highly intelligent people in the jail. Don't think they're sort of from another planet. And then this guy, I got to know him very well. He was the guy in those stories about my first time in jail when I went to teach meditation, when 100 people turned up to my meditation class in the Canning Vale jail again, about the number of prisoners there that time was about 110. So about 90% of the whole prison came to learn meditation. And after teaching meditation for 5 minutes, this guy became a good friend afterwards, a very sort of funny guy, but really big. Now he stood up and he said, can I ask a question? And this guy, I mean, he was really a big man, you know, with scars all over him, a blonde guy. I forget what his name is now, it's many years ago. And he said, can I ask a question? And when I saw the size of him, I said, yes, sir. And he was the guy who first asked, is it true that through meditation you can learn to fly through the air and over walls? And actually asked that question. I realized why so many people came to learn meditation. They weren't interested in spiritual advancement. They just wanted to escape. That was really a stupid question, but it was true. It happened. And I said, well, maybe, you know, it takes many, many, many years of special people to be a really special meditator before you can levitate. The next week I came, there were only 3 people turned up for my class. But it was the same guy, you know, I got to know. From that very early time. The guy who asked the question, he was in my class. You got one of those security pens too, he said. And then he looked at me really seriously. He said, Ajahn Brahm, do you really think you could press that button before I grabbed you and raped you? And I said, no. You're probably much faster than that. He said, yeah, really much faster than that. If I wanted to, I could get you very easily. But he said, you don't have to worry. We like you in here. So if any of these guys tried it, I'd get to them first. That was my security pen. I'd been kind enough to the prisoners in jail that they respected me. They loved me. And that's why I had no fear. That's why I didn't need any security. I trusted them, and they repaid my trust. Now that's something which I learned from an early time, and that's something which I ask you to do now. If you trust and give that full trust, the times you'll be hurt, yeah, you will be hurt a few times, but the times you're not hurt will be far greater, simply because the power of trust. My father and mother trusted me. It's a wonderful thing to be able to, you know, they say, off you go, come back at a certain time. And they never followed me. They never asked where I went at night. They were out with my friends. They trusted me. And I knew they trusted me. And because I knew they trusted me, there was something there that I was given a gift. I was given something precious. To me, trust, even though I was a, you know, just a young teenager, I knew that was important. As I think each one of you know that trust is really important. If you have someone who gives you trust, it's rare in a modern world. And you know it's valuable because it's rare. And therefore, I don't want to harm this trust. I'm stupid if I spoil this trust. And so that was why, that, you know, if I was caught up, I was late. I'd always ring my mum and dad and say, look, I'm late. So thanks, okay, whenever you get home, get home. Don't make a noise. And that trust which I was given, I valued so much that I did really live up to it. And when I've given that trust, I give that trust to all monks and the nuns in our communities here in Perth. I've often sort of said that one day I'm going to install CCTV cameras in every monk's hut to make sure they get up at the right time and always meditating. But what sort of monastery would that be? Would that be like a spiritual place? That would be just like a prison, like some detention center somewhere. That's not how... No, you want to develop a beautiful, spiritual, high-meaning sort of home for people. We don't want to be checking up on other people. We trust them. So I trust all my monks. So, you know, here are the huts. This is what you should be doing. If you feel tired and you want to sleep in, fine, I trust it. I trust that you know what you're doing. And I trust that you make those decisions. If you make wrong decisions, fine, you live with the consequences. But I'm not going to be an abbot who's always going to check up on you and find out, you know, fill in your report card. You know, having these, I've seen actually in working sites, they have these little things. You clock in the time you go to work and you clock in when you get off. I'm not going to give you these cards, so you have to clock in when you go to the meditation hall and clock in when you go out, and I can see how many hours you meditated during the week. If you haven't meditated enough, then you know you'd only get half rations at lunchtime. That's not the way we sort of run monasteries, because there's no trust there. And that's what we call like the fault-finding mind, which is the opposite of the trusting mind. The fault-finding mind is when you're always on somebody's back, expecting the worst of them. That's why you have CCTV cameras everywhere, because you expect someone to make a crime. That's why you keep looking over other people and checking out what they're doing, because you expect them to sort of be making mistakes. That's why you have bosses maybe checking up on your work, or you know, in your cubicles in the office. They're almost expecting you to make mistakes. That's a terrible workforce to live in. There's no trust. So when there is trust there, it's a far more beautiful environment to live in, and because it's a more beautiful environment to live in, a more positive environment, I'm sure that you will get much more out of the people who work there. They say, look, I trust you, I'm not going to check out on what you're doing during the day, as long as you get that work done to a high standard. But I trust you, look, now this company, we can't afford to go under, you know, we're all in this company together. If the company goes bust, you lose your job, I lose my job, we all lose jobs. So trust each other and engender that trust and create that trust and make the reasons for trust very clear in people. Now, trust is a great gift, and without it we live in a terrible society of fear and suspicion. We live in a relationship of fear and suspicion. We live in a family with fear and suspicion. And where will that be? Also, trust also gives people the benefit of the doubt. Because when you have a suspicious mind, which is the opposite of the trusting mind, your partner does something, they come home late, and you never give them the benefit of the doubt. You always think the very worst. And not giving people benefit of the doubt is a terrible world to live in. Even if they have cheated you, even if they have lied to you, give them the benefit of the doubt. It's a much better world to live in. And you find that most of the time people haven't cheated you, they haven't lied, they haven't done anything wrong. Sometimes you just misinterpreted the facts. I don't know how many times this happened, that people have just got the wrong end of the stick. You know, you've come home late because something has, you know, really happened in the office, or you've said something and they've totally misunderstood what you meant. And sometimes that when you don't have trust, you don't give the benefit of the doubt at all. Sometimes you don't know why another person did that. I don't know why you did that or why you said that, but I trust you. I give you the benefit of that. You must have had your reasons. So giving people the benefit of the doubt that way takes away a lot of the anger and the ill will and a lot of the growth of mistrust in our world. I think it's much more positive in families, in communities, in our world, to give people the benefit of the doubt. Because I like the benefit of the doubt. Sometimes, you know, even myself get criticized over much, especially with this bhikkhuni thing. And think, just why are you saying that? That's not what happened. Why don't you give me the benefit of the doubt? When you give the benefit of the doubt, you're reestablishing trust. And trust is growing. There's something bigger than finding fault. And when you have that trust, we have something which is very beautiful and very noble in this world. Because the alternative when we don't trust anybody, when we're paranoid, when we say something, what do you mean by that? You say good morning to somebody, and said, now what are you trying to get? And it means you can't say a kind word to anybody without somebody imputing some malicious motive or some Machiavellian scheming behind the good morning you say to someone. Your husband comes on and says, good morning, darling. So what do you want? What terrible crime you want to sort of admit today? Isn't it terrible when we don't trust each other like that? We're just so suspicious. So instead of having a suspicious mind, instead of having a mind which doesn't trust, give people the benefit of the doubt. If someone says good morning, I think, oh, that actually must mean that. Good meaning. Thank you very much. Just like I remember years ago, I was in the town of Darlington in the north of England. I was helping Ajahn Sumedho teach a retreat. We went for a walk in the morning. And somebody came by and called Ajahn Sumedho Superman because of his robe, because that's what he looked like. And we had a choice of getting upset. Now, was he actually really criticizing us, like trying to upset us by calling us Superman? Or was it like a compliment? So we decided, let's take it as a compliment. Give him the benefit of the doubt. That must have meant that we were superpower monks. So you have a choice to trust and give people the benefit of the doubt or see the very worst interpretation of things. Which one are you going to take? You've got a choice to trust the government or give the worst possible interpretation of their intentions. Isn't it terrible, this, the way we treat governments and politicians? I know a few politicians that have become good friends as part of my job. And, you know, for the most part, they're very honest people. They really are trying their best. It's an impossible job. The only reason I think, you know, people are stupid to be politicians, the amount of criticism you get in the press and from everybody else, they're really trying their very best. And I couldn't do a good job as they do, probably. I'd do much worse. They're not perfect. What a terrible job there is. Why don't we trust them? They try to do the best. And sometimes they fail, especially in Australia. I mean, the amount of corruption in Australia politics is very, very low compared to some other countries. So we're very, very lucky to have, you know, decent politicians trying their best. Yeah, they make mistakes, but they try their best. Wouldn't it be wonderful to trust them? Could you do that? The whole culture has been teaching us for years, don't trust, be suspicious, make sure that they got unscrupulous motives, maybe not to make money for themselves, but just to get into power again and to enjoy the trappings of power. Is that what they're really there for? I think most of them actually are there for very, very high motives. They really want to make a difference. They really want to do something good for the world. However, they're treated so badly by human beings. The default position is to distrust a politician. And I think they live up to that distrust. They live up to that suspicion. In other words, they become more suspicious. But I think if we trusted them more and gave them that trust, I think they would rise to a higher standard. Just like anybody else, your kids, if you give them trust, they rise to the occasion, they live up to that trust. Otherwise, what sort of world do we want to live in? A world of suspicion, a world of fault-finding, a world of just assuming that people are cheating on us, that people are abusing us, that people are in it for themselves. To my understanding, that's not the way this world is. Most people have got good hearts. They just want that goodness to be encouraged and recognized. I think anyone here will know just how good they are. They just want their goodness inside to be recognized. To say, look, please trust me, I'm a good person. Not the best person, I do make mistakes, but I'm pretty good and I'm trying my best. Trust me. And let me sort of live up to that trust. I will make mistakes, I won't be perfect, but please give me forgiveness. At least give me that opportunity to be honest with you. So that at least there's someone I can actually say I made a mistake. And they trust my motivation and I'm trying to do the very best. If we actually trust the motivations of human beings, I think many conflicts could be overcome. Trust the motivation of people at war. They're trying to do the a lot of times they're trying to do the best with the limited situations, but they don't listen to each other. They're always suspicious around the round tables. Never actually taking what is said on face value, but thinking that there's lies and complicity going along. When is that lack of listening because of lack of trust? Wherever could there be any solutions to life? So I think that trust is something which is a very important part of our life. And don't wait for trust to be earned in life. Give that trust. Especially if you want a relationship with another person, if you want a relationship with yourself, if you want a better world, especially a better family. give trust to your husband, your wife, your children. They usually live up to it. In fact, most times, in my experience, 90% of the time, 95% of the time, they do live up to trust. Don't be afraid. Let them make mistakes. When they make a mistake, give them trust again. And make this sense of honesty the most important, so at least people are able to come up to you and share their weaknesses, to allow mistakes to happen. You find that if you do allow mistakes, less happen in the world. And most importantly of all, please trust yourself. Allow yourself to make mistakes. You don't need to be so damn perfect. I'm not perfect. Don't know how many times I tell the same old joke, but I do my very best, always to try and find new ones. It's just so hard these days to find new jokes with the internet. You find a new joke and someone's already heard it. It's already been around the world 2 or 3 times. A lot of the jokes I hear I can't really repeat on a Friday night. They're a bit sort of unmonkish. But they're very funny. I share it with the monks, but I'm afraid I can't share it with you. But anyway, there was a little joke which I heard about this that somebody told the other day. About sort of the wife, you know, shouted out, well, what do you want for dinner this evening? Chicken, lamb, or beef? And the husband said, chicken, dear. And the wife said, I'm not talking to you, I'm talking to the dog. Which I think is typical of our modern world. But anyway, the trust yourself, which means it gives you confidence. And it means that you will go forward in life. You will experiment. You will sort of break new ground. You will grow. You won't stagnate. Because you trust yourself that, yeah, you can try new things. And if you do make a mistake, it's forward failing. You learn from it. And you trust yourself, you'll be able to do it. Trust in your friends. Trust in the people who love you and care for you, which are many more than you really believe. And that way that you can have a more positive life, and especially in the spiritual life. Trust your abilities. I don't know how many times people come up and say, oh, I can't meditate. I said, no, trust yourself. Give it a try. No, I can't get into jhanas. Give it a go. Who knows? Trust yourself. Don't be so self-doubting. If you don't make it, at least you tried. Allow yourself to make a mistake. And trust yourself. You're far more powerful than you think. That's called trust. So, thank you for listening this evening. On trust. Wow, that was very weak clapping. Thank you. Very good. Yeah. That's much better. Thank you so much. So, any questions on this evening's talk about trust and honesty and allowing yourself to make mistakes? Yes. Yeah, sometimes if it's just one person, one particular difficult person, yeah, maybe give them a bit of space for a while. But don't take away your trust for all human beings. So you don't just judge everybody just by one or two sort of unfortunate people you come across in your life. Because that's sometimes what happens. Sometimes people get really hurt and they don't trust anybody. Which means they're very, very lonely in their life. So, you know, just because one or two people have hurt you, don't put your heart in a concrete bunker and don't come out. Come out. You get hurt again, for sure, but that's much better than being so alone. So don't take away your trust for yourself and trust to all other people. Being hurt in life is where we grow. It's called growing pains. We can't take too much growing pains all at one go, so walk away sometimes. Is that the only question? Yes. Okay, you're using the word vulnerability, which is a very good word, that we all are vulnerable. We all can get hurt. But when we allow ourselves to get hurt, it's almost as if that vulnerability disappears.
We're only really vulnerable if we don't want to be hurt. We just can't stand being hurt. When you embrace being hurt as part of life, and it's, you know, growing pains, that's why forward failing, growing pains, you give these negative feelings a positive slant, it sort of puts in a different light. Yeah, you're vulnerable. And my body is very vulnerable. That's why as a kid you used to play soccer and get hurt all the time. Yeah, it's very vulnerable. That toughened the body up. It's a very fragile body. It's very easily bruised and cut and bones get broken. But that's where you get learn from. You can't just go through life without breaking a bone or cutting or getting sick. We are vulnerable, but we accept that. And that's how we grow and learn in life. And so emotionally we're vulnerable, incredibly vulnerable. But we allow ourselves to get hurt because that's where we understand how to really grow spiritually. I've told many young people who have their first broken love affair, you don't really know how to love until your heart has really been sort of busted in two. In other words, from vulnerability, from pain, you grow. You really learn. It's the old simile in the book of the truckload of dung. You need dung, you need shit to grow a good garden. If you don't have any shit in your life, you will never have beautiful flowers or trees in your garden. That's, you know, just making it quite blunt. So you have to be vulnerable. I know a few people who, you know, are, as you know, who do wear emotional suits of armor. Don't allow themselves to feel sometimes. They're so afraid of hurting. And I think you know a few people like that. They're just terrible people to be around. Yeah, they've been hurt before, but they can't actually feel, they can't love, they're not really participating in life. Yeah, they don't feel any cold, they don't feel any heat either. They're just in suits of emotional armor, and that's no way to live at all. So be vulnerable. Yeah, you get hurt. Trust in that, because you grow. Does that answer the question? Yeah. Sorry? Where do people go when they commit suicide? They usually get reborn, and just because they commit suicide, it's not a bad rebirth. Similarly, just to make this very clear, is that there's one, I don't know if the parents are here this evening, they usually come most evenings, their kid committed suicide just before the TE exams. He's doing very well. No reason why. Still don't know why people commit suicide, but there it was, committed suicide. And of course they were very distraught. And I said, look, in the TE exams, how many exams did you have? How many subjects? And they said about four or five. Say five subjects. How many papers in each subject? Two. I didn't really know where I was going with this. So that's 10 papers. Maybe say five questions on each paper. So that's 50 questions. Decide whether you're going to get to university or not. So you've got 50 questions. If you stuff up one question, does that mean you're not going to go to university? Of course not. So committing suicide is stuffing up one question. But keep that in perspective of everything else you've done in your life. So you can't measure a person's life just by the ending. Yeah, they committed suicide. It's a stupid thing to do. But what about all the other things they did in their life? Does that count for nothing? Of course it doesn't. So when you look at their whole life, not just their ending, their whole life, they're probably a really good person. Did a lot of kindness, a lot of love, a nice person to be around. But you know, the last question in the exam, they messed up that answer. But the rest of the questions were perfect. So such a person would get a good rebirth. But if they've lived a terrible life and been selfish and hurtful and cheated on everybody and everything else, then it doesn't matter how they end their life, they're still going to have a bad rebirth. So don't just judge a life by the way it ended. Life is bigger than the end. Much bigger. But anyway, sometimes you don't know why a person did these things. So it's very hard to judge. What I really don't like is people who say, suicide, therefore you're going to go to hell, it's the worst thing to do, it's a bad thing. I don't know where people get those ideas from. It's already bad enough if a loved one has committed suicide. You hear those other stupid people go along and
saying, oh, they're going to go to hell is a bad thing to do. That makes it so much worse, and it's untrue. So, look at the whole life, not just the ending. And trust a good person will get a good rebirth. That makes sense. Okay, last question, Eddie. Yeah. Well, look, you say I should go out there and spread more trust in this world because there's too much mistrust. I just come back from Indonesia. That's again where I got the cough. Many, many cities there, through Sumatra and Java and Sulawesi and Borneo or Kalimantan. And that book, Open the Door of Your Heart, and some new stories translated into Indonesian. They've been published. They are legitimate bestsellers. They're in the bookshops next to Harry Potter. So, I mean, that's real bestsellers up there. And so I did many, a couple of book launches with, you know, hundreds of people lining up to sign it. And many of them were Muslims, you know, in their veils. And so there you are actually doing something already. And they look at that book and they say, this is wonderful. Do I have to be a Buddhist? And they say, no, you can be a Muslim because these are stories about trust, about love, about forgiveness. They apply to everybody. So I'm doing my bit anyway. So with many, many Muslims in Indonesia, it's a beautiful country, Indonesia, because the religions over there are living in pretty much harmony. And that's why that, you know, they, I give talks and about 30% are Muslim and 10% are in, Christian and the rest are Buddhists. And no one knows who, well actually sometimes you know who's who because some of the women wear the veil. But other than that, you wouldn't know. Why? Is because, you know, you give the trust, you give the kindness, you give the love, and that's what people want. They want ways and encouragement to be more trusting, more forgiving. Because these sorts of teachings are universal. And it's true, pointing out, and this was actually from an email which they sent to me this afternoon, there is too much mistrust in our world. And don't think the world has to earn your trust. No, no, no. You have to give trust. It's not someone else's problem. You have to have the strength and the courage and the willingness to be let down. But you have to give trust. Otherwise, no one will give it. It has to start from each one of us. Okay. Thanks for listening.